From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Dr. Doom, Ed Dames joins us. The kill shot. Need I say anything more? Here's what's happening. Well, they were shaking in Maine tonight. An earthquake based in Maine sent tremors through the entire region, prompting the phones to ring off the hook at the National Weather Service and police departments. The quake, registering 4.6 on the Richter scale, centered southwest of Lake Arrowhead in Maine, west of Portland, Maine. Nobody was hurt. Well, the second of three presidential debates held tonight, this one at Hofstra University in New York. President Barack Obama, the Democrat, Republican candidate Mitt Romney, Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. John, I watched the debate, and I thought the president did much better. He was much more aggressive than he was in the first one.
Well, I think he really had a difficulty transitioning from being, quote, presidential into being the gladiator. And remember that the movie Gladiator, Maximus said to the slave owner said to Maximus, the beating heart of Rome is not the marble of the Senate. It's the sand of the Colosseum. And things haven't changed in a couple thousand years because people want to see these two get down and take the fangs out and the nails and beat each other up, basically. And that's what we saw last night.
Were you impressed with the presentation by both candidates?
Well, I mean, Romney basically was very consistent, I think. And, you know, he stuck pretty much to his talking points. I think Obama, on the other hand, really hit him with everything but the kitchen sink, all of the things he had said about Romney on the stump in many of his campaign ads. So I think that the overall performance, who won, who lost, I think it has to go to Obama because he had such a feckless performance in the first debate, and this one came off more aggressive and certainly more assertive.
All right, John, thank you so much. Dr. John Curtis, the final presidential debate will be held Monday night at Lynn University in Florida, gearing up, of course, for the election on November 6th. We've got our Insta poll going up at coasttocoastam.com right now. You can go and register your vote. The question is, who do you think won the second presidential debate? You can also look at the current results right now. Food stamps enrollment hitting a new record high. 46,681,833 Americans are now enrolled in the social welfare program, according to the United States Department of Agriculture. That's the federal agency that runs that program. Criminal investigators from the Food and Drug Administration reportedly at the offices of the Massachusetts Compounding Pharmacy that's at the center of this nationwide fungal meningitis outbreak. U.S. legislators demanding that the Department of Justice investigate whether the New England Compounding Center violated federal laws or regulations. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says 233 illnesses, 15 deaths in 15 states linked to the outbreak. The Salmonella outbreak linked to a New Mexico peanut supplier has expanded again with a voluntary recall of thousands of bags of whole peanuts by the Heinz Nut Company. The Dallas-based company recalled bags of salted jumbo Virginia in-shell peanuts for possible contamination with Salmonella. The peanuts were processed by the Sunland Company of New Mexico. Federal inspectors have seized nearly 1,400 Chinese-made pirate costumes for Halloween being shipped to Seattle after high levels of lead were found in the buttons and the trim. The costumes, all worth about $10,000, had 11 times the legal limit for lead. South Carolina man who was found in a suspected mobile meth lab reportedly told police that he was ghost hunting in a cemetery. The 36-year-old man was charged by the Spartanburg Public Safety Department with manufacturing methamphetamine after an officer spotted three people standing near a pickup truck in the Oakwood Cemetery. Good news for Gary McKinnon. The Home Secretary in the United Kingdom, Theresa May, defying American authorities by halting the extradition of the British computer hacker Gary McKinnon, a decision criticized by the U.S. State Department, welcomed by campaigners and politicians across parties in the United Kingdom. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, said the reason she did this was because of human rights grounds, medical reports warning that the 46-year-old McKinnon was suffering from depressive illness and could kill himself if he was sent to the U.S. on trial. He was first indicted by an American grand jury back in 2002 for hacking into U.S. military computers, including the Pentagon and NASA, from his North London bedroom while he said he was looking for information about UFOs. And what happened in Webster Parish in Louisiana? According to numerous reports, a loud boom was heard in a secluded area of the Louisiana parish. According to the sheriff out there, he said something definitely happened, but what was it? One resident said she saw the sky light up with a bright orange color. Let's turn to Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, did you get any calls on this one?
Not as far as I know, George. I've been out of town here for a few days, and I'm still sorting through accumulated reports and email. But as far as I know, we didn't receive anything from any of the principal witnesses to it. But generated a little preliminary interest. We thought it might be a meteor or meteorite if it hit the Earth, of course. But it sounds as though in the follow-up investigation, they pretty well determined that it was a stockpile of black powder that blew up in a bunker and created quite a boom. The one question I have about that report is, what is the military doing storing black powder? It's oftentimes unstable, and I have no idea what they would use black powder for unless it's fireworks on the 4th of July. So an interesting report, but I don't think it has anything to do with meteors or UFOs.
Not at this time. Peter, thank you so much. Peter's website linked up with our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. One of the most incredible UFO stories I have heard in a long time, a couple weeks ago, came out of Veterans Today talking about a joint Chinese-U.S. naval operation. Why? Because maybe of an unfriendly extraterrestrial threat. We're going to talk with the senior editor of Veterans Today, Gordon Duff, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Gordon Duff, senior editor of Veterans Today, former U.N. diplomat, United States Marine Corps Vietnam combat veteran, deputy chairman of the board of European-based multinational companies. His career has included extensive experience in international banking, along with such diverse areas as consulting and counterinsurgency, surveillance technologies, intelligence. And we're tracking the story that was in the Veterans Today several weeks ago. It's an incredible story about Asian intelligence agencies reporting that a combined fleet operation between the U.S. and China has been going on against what possibly could be unfriendly extraterrestrial threats. It's an amazing story. We've got Gordon on the air here with us. Gordon, how are you?
George, I'm doing pretty well, George.
Good. It's good to have you with us. You know, I spent 9 years in the Navy, and I want to just thank you for your service, Gordon. Any relation to Jim Duff, who is a dear friend of mine in St. Louis? Because there's not many Duffs around.
I know. It's, I don't think we're successful breeders. there's some evidence to that.
Tell me about Veterans Today, and then we'll get into this incredible story.
Well, Veterans Today's began in just a little after 2000, it was set up by the U.S. Special Forces as a back channel for Special Forces people to be able to discuss off the record their own experiences. It was set up on servers outside the U.S. In around 2006, I took this site over, thought I would make it more international because we deal with a lot of allies, and to a great extent, people that serve in special operations have special problems. A lot of them suffer from post-traumatic stress.
Yes.
A lot of people that work special operations, Navy SEALs, U.S. Special Forces, Marine Force Reconnaissance, Naval Intelligence people, have a severe need to gossip and gossip with each other. And we needed to have people with the ability to speak with each other and yet have people around with good enough sense never to publish any operational intelligence. So people are allowed to say to each other here pretty much anything, and almost nothing hits. And this is one of the unusual points I got into. I work for a large defense contracting firm as one of the senior officers. We do 35 billion euros a year. And when it came down having to deal with this story and hit the publish button after receiving two confirmations I only hope that the people who write my paychecks would forget my name was on the top of it.
I got to tell you, it's a story that went all over the place, Gordon. And how did it come to you? How did you pick this up?
The first thing we had, I had about 4 days of reports. A couple of years ago, a Chinese submarine had fired a missile off the coast of really Los Angeles.
Yes, I remember that.
And that was, we have a lot of senior Air Force, a lot of NASA people with us. For instance, Clinton Baston, the chief nuclear weapons designer for the Department of Energy for 41 years, is one of our advisors. General Hamid Gull, former head of the ISI. Eugene Khrushchev from Russia's intelligence is one of our editors. So we have a broad group of people here. And so we had good reports from people when this Chinese rocket went up. They watched the plume. They knew what the fuels were. They knew it was a very primitive quality rocket compared to ours. We're wondering why the Chinese had done this. So we began watching the movements of the Chinese. We began watching the movements of the old Russian submarines in the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. the return of the bear bombers on the flights from Moscow down to Cuba. We began seeing people stretching their legs a little bit, so we became wary. And not because we necessarily mean anything, but it's like a racehorse. You never know when to stop.
That's right. That's true. I used to own a few of those. I know what you're talking about. Well, with this incredible story, I mean, was it leaked to you with some special sources? I mean,
well, the Navy had began to we get simple calls saying that we have pretty much the entire Chinese Navy off San Francisco. It's not a compared to our Navy. They're fairly humorous.
Sure,
they were there. They were operating with Japanese, they were operating with South Koreans. We had as many as five of their nuclear submarines there. We were making no attempts to watch them at all. And, you know, we have our own ships that head out, and we were getting reports that people were, they were afraid of running into, there were so many ships out there, that we knew a military operation of some kind was going on. I didn't begin to guess. Now, one of the tough things here that we're going to break into right off is during the news you talked about the Gary McKinnon story.
Right.
McKinnon's claim is that he had hacked the records of essentially James Kirk and Starfleet. He found the pay records for us running a major extraterrestrial capability, and I have no knowledge specifically of that. But over a long career, let's say 43 years, working initially, I went to Vietnam as a private first class. Hmm. But over a career, I worked at reasonable levels with the intelligence groups. And when I travel now, I meet typically with heads of intelligence agencies, chiefs of armies, or chiefs of state. It's not unusual. And frankly, you know, there are 192 countries. You can't cross the street without running into a chief of state.
So you get some pretty heavy sources that come your way.
We get very heavy sources. And the first issue we got is, and this is where the leap has to be, that we're living, and this is why Gary McKinnon's important, and so many other people that come forward are important, that we have two sets of technologies. One they tell people about that we really have,
mm-hmm.
and then one we know we have. Now, early on, I've got a couple of areas I work in. One of them is, as a corporation, we work in green energy. And as we work on government projects, we have people that work in classified areas. So one of my assistants, who is a retired senior Army intelligence officer, spent 18 months working on an energy project with DARPA. And the energy project became very clear to him, involved many types of fusion energy, both cold fusion and hot fusion, neutronic and aneutronic, meaning bomb-related, or let's say hydrogen-boron. that were, to some extent, very probably reverse-engineered non-terrestrial technologies.
And reversed by a willing participant of ET intervention, or something we might have picked up from something crashed, for example?
Well, I'll give you one strange experience I had. I've had, you know, in a lifetime, it's difficult for someone who even works close to this world to say, you know, I've worked constantly with these projects. Well, some people may have my entire lifetime experience of working close to UFO issues comes to 2 hours over a period of 43 years.
Okay.
In 1982, I was put on the readers group for Majestic 12. I received an original copy, slightly redacted, done off a typewriter dated August 23rd, 1977, from the Office of Naval Intelligence, that about 12 pages long, and it was done, I had copy number 5 done on just plain flimsies from the, you know, the manual Remington typewriter years.
Oh, I remember those. Yeah.
Well, I read it once, and I was working for a government agency at the time and had a very high security clearance. It took me 18 months to be cleared for the reading group. I read the documents once and put them back in the envelope, twisted the string around, returned to sender, sent them back, and found that I could never live knowing what was on those. And then years later, lo and behold, almost everything that was in those documents was later on the plot of the television show X-Files.
As if somebody gave them to the producer.
I've been told that Chris Carter was put on the reading group of Majestic 12.
What was in those documents, Gordon, that frightened you?
The documents covered the period from 1947 to 1977 when they were produced. They indicated that over this period we had two distinct treaties. There have been more since, I have been told. But one in 1947, initially with President Truman, one in 1953 with President Eisenhower. The 1950, and we're jumping right into the unpleasant area. The 1953 treaty with President Eisenhower was an agreement, a coercive agreement against the United States on the behalf of a hostile alien power that wished to be able to kidnap a number of citizens from the United States, which means, of course, they had agreements with other nations as well. And this is a critical thing that we may have time to talk about later. The number was unusually high. These were not people that were going to be detained and probed and returned. These were people that were going to be detained and butchered. They were very clear about this.
Why did they want to do this?
The impression I had, you know, and I'm an intelligence officer. I've got, I will, you know, grade what I say. The impression I got from reading the document is that we were dealing with people that there may have been groups within the groups we dealt with that had genetic interest in bloodlines within the world that had bred with humans and that were following genetic developments. This group in particular we were talking about had a simple interest in eating people.
Oh, my gosh. Sounds like To Serve Man from the Twilight Zone.
Exactly. And the problem we have is that so many of the movies we're running into, from the most recent Battleship, which very much correlates with this naval problem in the Pacific, to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was described in Majestic 12 as an incident that actually happened in 1965, almost word for word. So many of the things that we have had presented to us by Hollywood have strong origins within these classified documents, and it's as though these things are being released as a pre- preparation for disclosure somehow, movies like Independence Day and other such things, so that we're likely to take this.
To get us ready. Gordon, hold on. We're going to hit this break. We're going to come right back. A few more questions I've got for you, plus we're going to open up the phone lines. We're with Gordon Duff. He is the senior editor of Veterans Today, and we're talking about a number of things, including this apparent joint U.S.-Chinese mission off the coast, combating some extraterrestrial threat. And welcome back with Gordon Duff. Gordon, this treaty that was done in 53, I assume it was done because we didn't have much of a choice, did we?
We were considerably ill-armed. However, in 1953, and I had gotten this from President Reagan's chief intelligence analyst, Leo Wanta, the United States had tested its first anti-gravity space device, which we have in storage at the United Kingdom at the Bryce Norton Air Base, called the TB2. It was a very primitive craft built by Lockheed using a Mercury and a Linco 5 magnetic system. It floats around like a giant hockey puck about the size of a 747. I've actually seen it. I got about 20 minutes look at it about 2 years ago. Huh. And a lot of green flaking paint, a lot of stained aluminum, and it's a lot of very unairworthy aircraft powered by two primitive jet engines off a B-36, but that was our first anti-gravity machine. Part of the story here that that we're looking at right now, the Pacific story, is that, and these were the things I received intelligence agency real confirmations from, is that we were dealing with an entity, one that technically wasn't, and there are as many as 12, we are told, that the varying nations of the world are dealing with, and if only I were making this up, I wish I was.
I wish you were, too.
That this one is unusually unfriendly. I was told to reference the film Independence Day, that they live in underwater bases, had notified us that they were going to bring motherships in and settle in the Pacific Basin. They had moved one off Catalina Island. The U.S. Navy was heavily involved in the Persian Gulf and called on other world navies, Singapore, China, and others, to fill in. That our initial response was a couple of launches of... we had tested maybe 3 months ago or so a Mach 13 vehicle out of Vandenberg.
Right. That didn't work, right?
Well, that vehicle, we've had working versions of that for some time. They work much faster than Mach 13, and they carry an energy cannon based on a Tesla design. And I have some engineering background. You and I are both Detroit kids from about the same time,
That's right.
Now we can have that talk about going to the Ford Rotunda to see Santa Claus someday.
That's right.
Yeah. But what people are unaware of, and what most people are unaware of, is that the treaties that limited the use of weapons in space have all been abrogated, that within orbit we have many nuclear weapons. The U.S. has a fleet of small fusion-powered hunter-killer satellites that are designed ostensibly to at a time of war to destroy enemy communication satellites, to take down the GPS system, to protect the United States. They all, in actuality, are aimed outward. That we have high-energy weapons that operate on technologies a century beyond what we admit having, that aim out toward space, and within the upper atmosphere and in low Earth orbit, we have sensors. These are nanosensors. This is as much classified information as I can safely give over the Internet.
Why don't they want us to know about this, Gordon?
I can only give you my guess that One of the units that you can look at on the internet, and you can extrapolate from this, is the dense plasma hydrogen-boron fusion reactor that produces enough waste electricity out of something the size of a basketball to equal a nuclear plant and cost about $70,000 to build. The issue, by saying it's a Malthusian issue, meaning that if the planet had free, unlimited energy, it would not only cause the continually concerned economic collapse because hydrocarbons would become valueless, but it would allow all nations endless free electricity, endless purified water, endless industrialization, endless desalinized seawater, that the world population would move from what it is now. And there's a dispute about what it is. It's claimed to be 7. Some people say it's only 3.6, 3.8 billion people. But that we would, within a generation, if we had free energy, reach a population level of 25 billion that would be, to some, unsustainable.
Unsustainable, yeah.
And then you have to realize that if you believe there's a secret conspiracy group of, let's say, blue ticket holders like in X-Files, the ones that say when the aliens come, they're going to join the aliens and watch the rest of us be turned into human shish kebabs, that those people tend to look on the rest of us, if those people actually exist, and that would be a conspiracy theory. But they use the term useless eaters. And I think you may have heard that before, George.
You sure have. So these groups of extraterrestrials that are unfriendly, many of which are hiding down there at the bottom of the ocean, what do they plan to do? Are they going to emerge one day? What do they want?
This group in particular had decided that it was reasonable for them to seize the entire Pacific Basin, saying it in a rather Hitler-esque fashion. This is all we want, and I know the protections we were using from them, the unpleasant surprise is that we have the ability to shoot down their vehicles. We have high-energy weapons that make the things that we tell people we have look like a childish joke, and those nanosensors we were talking about don't just sense the presence of things, but they look for distortions in space and time. There are issues of, and of course, you know, the CERN collider,
right,
discovered the God particle, which enters on the beginnings of a clear understanding of a unified field theory. We disproved within the last couple of years, general relativity. So we know that it's possible to operate well outside of the speed of light, that time is in no way an absolute, and that interdimensional travel is something that is far more likely than someone physically moving over distances. The detections we have here are exactly out of Hollywood, or more dangerously, from this season of Fringe, and that's the same network. But we have a season of Fringe that very much approaches the kinds of threats that we're potentially facing. And the question that I look at here, and I can see myself some 20, 30 years ago, that you can live. And, you know, let's say Gary McKinnon may have been right, but you can live looking at these things and seeing them, and you have children and grandchildren, mm-hmm. or you can look away and hope that the other shoe doesn't drop during your lifetime.
Stick your head in the sand and just wish.
What we do have is we do have a government that has spent trillions of dollars developing weapon systems that are beyond our imagination, but in the process of advancing those technologies, has they all, as with the early space program and the development of Velcro, you know, the newer technologies have allowed us to essentially replace most energy sources that we talk about. We have, and there are, you know, there are many people who publicly speak about these things, but most people who do so are tasked with doing so in a harmless way or in a way that can easily be discredited. There's a reason I'm talking here right now, and it's not by any means that anyone underrates your the ability of your network. Of course, I'm dealing with one of the largest and most powerful networks in the world. But the issue here is that I'm speaking informally, not under any official capacity. Mm-hmm. And, I assure you, I received a telephone call today telling me things I couldn't talk about. Now, I'll give you the exact limits here.
Okay.
I was told that I can say the first interstellar craft was built in 1972. I was told to say, and I'm not saying it's true, but by sufficient authority, highest authorities, that I'm capable of saying, and let's go right out and say, don't believe any of this, we're just kidding. But to say
well,
that
if you weren't the senior editor of a very prestigious Veterans Today internet site, one would say, okay, we won't believe it. But it's who you are, Gordon.
I have a tendency of being right.
True. Now, when you say they told you what to say, what if you said to them, I'm not going to? What would happen?
You know, it's funny in a business where you work with intelligence people, you work with lonely people. All any people in intelligence have are each other. At any given time, you can cross a line and a black dot can be put on you.
Yeah.
And more often than not, I have a something inside my head that, and I don't always agree with everything the U.S. government does, but I would cut off my foot before endangering the life of a single American soldier. I don't care what my feelings are about a war.
I believe that.
I know what I can and can't say. And I have the discipline to never do it. Then, on the other hand, when people tell you things, are they telling you the truth? Why are we getting, and this is, we've waited so many years for disclosure. You know what I'm talking about, George.
Sure, and they could be using you.
Oh, there's no question about it. We have seven craft. They're fusion-powered. Their diameter is... their circumference is 1.5 kilometers. One was photographed on YouTube over Busan, Korea, earlier in the year.
These things have been seen.
I have the CIA's full analysis released by the National Reconnaissance Office of Cosmic Classification. The deal made with me was simply this. We'll let you publish it. No one will believe it.
Huh.
I have the full analysis in high resolution done by the National Reconnaissance Office of a real Earth-built UFO flying at 300 feet with a surface temperature of 400 degrees, and it accelerates in the low atmosphere to 16,000 miles an hour with no change in temperature.
Amazing.
And outside the atmosphere, what I'm officially told is they can approach light speed, and that would mean hitting the pedal to the metal, and in 5 seconds you've got the moon is tiny in the mirror.
Let's take some calls here, Gordon. They're lining up for you in the minutes that we have left. We'll go to Charles in Roseburg, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Charles, go ahead. You're on with Gordon Duff.
Yeah, pleasure to be on your show tonight.
Thank you, Charles.
Right on. I just, I've heard, I have a lot of cousins in the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and right off the coast of Los Angeles, there's supposed to be a major underground UFO base about 20 to 22 miles out. Have you heard anything about that, sir?
Gordon, I think that's what you're talking about.
Your cousins should not be telling you that because it's true.
How far deep is this, like lying on the ocean floor?
The ocean floor, not that far down, and it's like out of another movie that we saw,
The Abyss?
Yes.
Remember that one?
Yes, it is.
Classic. Let's go to Glenn, Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Glenn. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, Glenn.
Hey, I was going to ask this guy a question. Pretty much simply, you know, why are you not 6 feet under? If you have a core of this stuff, that this knowledge is actually true, I mean, you know, I mean.
Oh, I can really answer that question. I have two administrative assistants. One is a former chief of Army Intelligence. The other is a two-star general from the FSB. I have on my payroll between 2,000 to 5,000 tier one individuals from both Russia and the United States, including enough Spetsnaz to fill a small stadium. I would probably leave me alone.
It might be smarter to do that.
I'd do it.
Out to Wyoming we go. Ken is a first-time caller. Go ahead, Kenny.
You guys said were mentioning Close Encounters of the Third Kind earlier, how it was based on a true event. I was chasing conspiracies the other night, and I ran across a website that took the coordinates that they supposedly got in the movie that went to the Devil's Tower in Wyoming.
Oh, sure. That's where it was. That's right.
They punched them into the Google Maps or Google Earth, and it went straight to DIA, Denver International Airport. So I had to give it my own shot, and I punched the coordinates right into Google Maps on the Google search engine, and bam, went straight to Denver International Airport. If I can jump in.
Yep.
There are some irregular operations in underground facilities attached to that airport.
Strange things happen at that airport. There is no doubt, Gordon, at all. Gordon, so what happens with this operation, this joint operation, Chinese, U.S., and some other countries?
One of the things between reality and television, George, is that we're given a certain amount of information. I'd like to be able to say there are heroes that gave their lives, that we won something, that we did something, that we proved ourselves. There's drama behind this, and the problem is it's drama that we should all be able to know because it's our lives, and there's no one to tell us. And at a certain point, they certainly cut me off because I'm curious, because these are the lives. We've lost people in wars with UFOs. We've lost people, and you know, we spend a lot of time honoring our heroes, and we have heroes that we don't know about, that we'll never know about. Families that are told that their sons, daughters, and husbands had died in traffic accidents or strange aircraft accidents or whatever. It's disturbing to that extent, because I think it's a debt. We have a debt to people who've defended us. And we'll never know who they are.
Well, and we know, Gordon, that hundreds of thousands of people worldwide merely vanish off the face of this planet. Nobody knows where they are. They're just gone.
I know the number that was written on the document I saw, and I have I'll simply tell you the number and write it down, 236,000, and I have no idea how 236,000 people in 1953 could disappear from the planet and people not notice. And when I read the number, and I knew I was reading a real document because of where I was sitting and where the building was and how I knew I got the document and how long it took, I can say it's as sick as I've ever felt in my life.
Gordon, I want you to come back again. Keep updating us on these incredible stories. Gordon Duff, senior editor of Veterans Today. When we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM, it's The Kill Shot. It's Major Ed Dames on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for years now, Major Ed Dames, Dr. Doom, has been on the program talking about incredible things that he and his remote viewing group have accomplished. We're going to talk about The Kill Shot tonight. We're going to talk about some of his past thoughts. We're going to talk about Mars. Up next, Major Ed Dames. Sports on Coast to Coast AM. The world's foremost remote viewer and teacher, Edward Dames. U.S. Army, decorated military intelligence, retired, of course. Original member of the U.S. Army Prototype Remote Viewing Training Program, he has served as the Training and Operations Officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency's Psychic Intelligence Collection Unit, serves now as the Executive Director for the Matrix Intelligence Agency, which is his private consultancy group, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Ed, how are you?
I'm fair at the Midland. Pleasure to be back, George.
Good, thanks, good. Ben. Personal life, family fine? Everybody good there?
So-so, okay. But life goes on.
Life goes on. Absolutely, it does. What is new with you professionally, Major Dames?
Well, lots of things. Heavy-hitting show tonight. We're going to broach subjects that have never been broached before on your show and let you know some inside stuff. But I would like to start off with one thing, if I may.
Yeah.
MJ-12, the documents.
That Gordon was talking about? Sure thing.
Yeah, I mean, anybody in the UFO community, so-called, knows about the MJ-12 documents. They're fake. They're fake. They're fake and because Project Blue Book never solved any of all the hypotheses that Project Blue Book put forward about the existence of UFOs and what they are. The problem was never solved. So the MJ-12 documents were fabricated to put out on the streets, to leak out on the streets as a trap door. So that first of all, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations at the beginning and then the rest of U.S. Intel could watch to see who was interested in those documents that the U.S. government put out and try to ferret out from civilian scientists and other technicians what the people that really might know the truth about UFOs. That's the story of the MJ-12 documents.
You sent me your DVD, The Kill Shot. Are you trying to scare the heck out of me, Ed?
I'm not. I'm trying to bring closure to some things and wrap up my career here and go on to other things, and it was a good way to do it.
Well, what do you mean, wrap up your career and go on to other things? What are you going to do?
I am going to pursue what I got out of the Army to pursue, and that's this, we'll talk about that tonight, this UFO ET enigma. I want to dedicate the rest of my career to that and rather than commercial projects and things like that. So I'm wrapping up some commercial projects.
Okay, all right. But you're still going to do remote viewing, aren't you?
Oh, stock and trade.
Okay, good, good. Hey, let's talk about some of the past things first, and then we'll move forward.
Yeah, let me give you a history, too. I don't want to start off specifically with Mars, but the history of how I got involved and remote viewers got involved in Mars. And that begins in the modern era in the 1970s when Ingo Swann and Harold Sherman, two great remote viewers, began to look at the planets that U.S. probes were heading toward, Mercury and Jupiter, and wonder if they could not ferret out scientific information that would be later confirmed by the probes that were heading that way. That turned out to be some of that information was correct and totally unknown and like rings around the planet Jupiter, for instance, that the probes actually discovered later on. But the big hallmark was when in terms of the history of remote viewers and Mars, was I did not start that. The first operations officer of the Army Sci-Spy unit got interested in that, at wondering what the natural psychics that we used then, we now call this technique extended remote viewing. It's essentially an altered state. You put a viewer in an altered state and you interrogate them in a dark room. Okay, and Joe McMonagle was one of the prime
initiators of this,
agents for this too. And so the first operations officer in the unit, when he wasn't into operations, and believe it or not, the unit, the Sci-Spy unit, wasn't used a lot by the community. I was the first one to be a technical scientific user of the unit. I came in from the outside, stepped down to take over the unit. Joe was reporting all kinds of things about Mars' past civilizations. To make a long story short, Ingo Swann picked that up along with Harold Puthoff at the Stanford Research Institute in 1983 and did it and took a team of remote viewers and psychics to look at certain coordinates on Mars. the psychics produced, and as well as Inga Swann, produced tons of information on an ancient civilization that was there, made up of at least two races. They were not technologically advanced, relatively peaceful. They had edge weapons and things like that. They were tall and thin. Mars, as you know, has one-third of the gravity of Earth, so if you're going to be a humanoid to grow there, you get to grow taller.
In terms of their technology, what era would you give them Earth-wise?
I give them probably the Mayan or Aztec acme.
Okay.
Yeah, well, no advanced edged weapons, but except obviously, in terms of the Aztecs, these people were not the advanced race, because there were two races that we know of, were not necessarily warlike. They just had to protect themselves from others, defend their cities. So what happened next, and our archaeologists in the future will have plenty to do on Mars for other reasons, too, that we'll discuss. And the demise of Mars was, I'll talk about Mars in the past, and I'll talk about it.
And what did it look like, Ed?
It was a world that was it looked very similar to the not the entire planet, but it was very reddish still. And it had a lot of water, as we're about to find out.
Vegetation?
Yes, lots of vegetation. Again, the only real difference, their structures were different. And they changed when these massive storms began to happen and finally extinguished the civilization. They started to build survival shelters. But when we discover this on the ground there, there'll be many, many underground rabbit warrens and places like that we discover. A lot of the cities had underground facilities, underground segments.
Did we have human life on this planet while this life existed on Mars?
Negative. Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't know. Did the vast spans of time are so difficult for us as technical remote viewers to ascertain that we can't do it.
I know we talked about that before. It's easy if you remote view and you see like a date on a newspaper or something.
No, we can't do that, George. Only natural psychics have that occasionally and spontaneously.
Okay, so time is very difficult for a remote viewer.
Yes, perhaps one day we can solve that. The best that we can do now is, of course, in contemporary eras, is to look at events that are immediately. For instance, when I predicted the Fukushima disaster, I looked at events that immediately preceded it that could be recognized. And that's the best that we can do in terms of a metric, or a loose metric, or a clock, when to predict an event, kill shot or otherwise.
Were there many inhabitants on that planet, on Mars?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the planet, yeah. There were at least two races, and there were a lot of people. Lots of people.
You talk about storms that affected them and wiped out the civilization. What kind of storms?
Well, vicious storms, violent storms, high winds, extremely high winds that lasted for about 10 years before about 15% of the population was left.
It just battered the planet, didn't it?
It did, in a very interesting way. The Genesis was a very large passing space body. You've heard me say this before, those of you who are listening to Killshot. A very large passing body. We don't know if it's a comet. We don't know if it's Planet X, although I'm starting to lean toward that in my old age. Got very, very close in this particular episodic pass through our solar system to the planet Mars at that time, very, very long ago. Got so close that it caused an extreme disturbance in the atmosphere of the planet Mars. And this, we looked at this closely. How did Mars lose its atmosphere? Because that's what happened. This disturbance was so great that it created waves of masses of atmosphere, air. These were generally air breathers, but there was a little bit of difference. Masses of gases that waves across the planet in a much more complex way than a drumhead surface, that crashed into each other. And when they did, if you stand along the shore of the ocean and see this path of least resistance, out goes this burst of air right out into outer space. It's lost. And this episodic event, these wave-like crashes of air over periods of time, years, started pushing large chunks masses of Mars atmosphere out into space. I'm not a geophysicist or an atmospheric physicist, so I can't explain this in those terms. But in layman's terms, I can. Until a threshold was reached where Mars essentially lost its atmosphere. At that point, most of the planet's human inhabitants, and we've never looked at the, as we have on Titan and Europa, we've never looked at the animals or anything else like that, but I'll qualify right. that in a moment, until about 15% of the population was still alive in these shelters, these pyramidal shelters that remote viewers have described in the past. And then, interestingly, these very silver things appeared in the atmosphere, put everybody to sleep, and they were gone.
Simple as that.
Simple as that. Well,
how sad.
Yeah. Now, again, to fill in the blanks of all those years using, and we're going to talk about this more tonight, it is very, very difficult. But we do know some things that are solid, some things that are gray zone, and some things that are speculative. But we want to talk about the solid things tonight, for instance. The carbon dioxide that's present in Mars' present atmosphere, Mars today, part of that is from microbes that are living in cracks and crevices near the surface of Mars.
I suspect that because they're picking up readings of methane and something's got to be causing that.
Microbes, yeah, yep. That too. That's the only thing that we found in terms of life forms, except for something else that I'll talk about, that stayed behind after the Martian civilization went away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What might that have been?
Sentient machines, robots. And let me begin that topic.
And where did they come from?
Oh, you think in terms of a federation. The idea of federation is real, and we'll elaborate upon that tonight. But let me start this off by saying that immediately after the Cold War was over, the Russians approached me, the Russian government approached me through a cutout, a general, a U.S. general, and asked if we, not knowing about us as remote viewers, asked if we could ascertain what happened when the Phobos-2 spacecraft that they put in orbit around Mars met its fate. The Phobos-2 spacecraft was supposed to explore, survey the planet, the second moon of Mars, Phobos, not Deimos. And it was a very enigmatic event where it looked as if there was something that came up from the surface of Mars and that actually came into physical contact with the Phobos-2 spacecraft, and after that it was all speculative. One of a famous Russian psychic said it was a UFO that came up from the surface. Well, indeed it was. It was a machine. So Paul Smith and I particularly drew and sketched this disc-like, discus thing. It looks sort of like a sand dollar that rose, very big, that rose up from the sands of Mars, the surface of Mars, took on what Paul described as something like, looks like the Sydney Opera House geometry, and then took off at relativistic speeds to meet the Phobos-2 spacecraft. Bam, up there. In fact, we as remote viewers have a very difficult time sketching these things in motion because they are traveling at relativistic speeds, and we're not used to that. We're used to physical things traveling at lots very fast
to
sketch them. And so it got in the vicinity of the Phobos-2 to check it out, and it actually touched it. It actually touched it.
It was almost like it gobbled it up, right?
No. It was actually thinking, this sentient machine, that's all it was, a very intelligent machine, was thinking that it was meeting one of its incoming owners and realizing, oh, no, this is something else.
Not too smart a machine.
Right. One could say that. In fact, that was my first thought. I thought, okay, this is supposed to be smart. But it was expecting something else and realizing, oh, no, this is not it. Like throwing a dog a bone and the dog realizes it's a rubber bone.
Yeah.
That idea there too. So we sent that report back to the Russians. But indeed, these things are on surface, and more importantly, I think what's controlling them is under the surface of Mars. There is a sort of a command center that I've talked about on Coast to Coast before too, and in that command center are essentially robots, and they've been there a long time. I think they've stayed behind. They are the ones that create the crop circles on Earth and If you want me to review how that's done, I can do it. They are the ones that are responsible for the Rendlesham Forest incident, for the Cash Landrum radiation incident.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just about every episode on this planet.
No. We're going to get into the other episodes. No, only a set, episodes. The crop circles are more important because there's an etch-a-sketch type of thing in this command center. A new crop circle is formed. Bam. These carbon tools are created on Earth, temporary tools. They cut the crop circle using cut loosely. We publish reports on technical aspects of this. Then they dissipate back into their component parts, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, whatever was used to make this ephemeral tool. And that's all done from this underground command post on Mars. I think one idea I have is that this calling card is asking us to find it. This is just one hypothesis that I have. It will take advanced consciousness tools to do that, and they know this. So it's actually promoting things like remote viewing to discover them. Because consciousness is the lingua franca out there. There's so many types and forms of life in the universe, some physical, some not. But consciousness is a standard.
Well, what's left on Mars then right now? Just the microbial life?
Microbial life, all the ruins, and then this underground active component, plus at least one of these big sand dollar disc things on the surface.
Will the rover Curiosity, for example, will it find any of this?
No, it's always looking down at geological stuff. I sat down once with Harrison Schmidt, I sat down with him because he was on the Defense Science Board, and I briefed the Defense Science Board on very high top secret stuff. And I said, okay, I briefed him on the existence of the remote viewing unit and said, this is what we found. He was the last man to walk on the moon as a geologist. So he would be interested, I think, in things like this. Yeah. I also talked to him about Titan, the largest moon of Saturn, what we found there, one of the most beautiful olivine rock. Oh, it looks like it's cut with a chiseled, at least the south side, north side of the canyon. It looks like it's been chiseled and carved. It's so beautiful and deep, one of the deepest canyons. And a life form that's found in the seas of Titan, like a saprophytic sponge or something like that.
Well, the things that you saw remote-wise on Mars doesn't surprise me. I mean, everybody has suspected the possibility that this was a very active, alive planet at one time.
No, I would disagree with you. I don't think that very many people even think about
the Hoagland crowd does.
Oh, in 19...
I mean, Richard said that Mars had water before any probe was even sent to tell us that.
Well, I was the Monuments of Mars was the second thing other than the first operations officer telling me about this. When I read that, when I saw the Monuments of Mars that Richard wrote, I became fascinated, and that got me interested. And in fact, as soon as I retired from the Army, I sent a proposal out, and Richard was on my was copied. I sent him a copy personally. And this was 1993, and I had a company then, and I proposed that $9,500 proposal to do a remote viewing survey of Cydonia crater.
Ah,
and so,
that would have been fascinating.
Oh yeah, well, Richard went to a subcommittee of either the Senate or the UN. I can't remember. Held my letter up.
I think he went to the UN.
Okay, he held my letter up and said, this is an attempt by the CIA to infiltrate my project, quote unquote. Anyway, a few months later, he found out about Ingalls Swan and Harold Sherman's work earlier in the decade. I went to meet Ingalls and said, could you remote view Mars for me? He said, Ingalls said, no, I'm retired, but it was one of my students has a company now, and he does that.
Hold on for a second, Ed. We're going to come right back. Major Ed Dames. Talk a little bit more about his remote viewing. We will talk about the kill shot and some of his past remote viewing projects. Some of them are getting pretty uncanny close. We'll be back. Well, Ed has supplied us, and we have his trailer. The kill shot trailer runs 1:42 on the coasttocoastam.com website. Go take a look at it. They've done a tremendous job. It's kind of scary, but you might want to see it. We'll be back in a moment with Major Ed Dames on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Major Ed Dames. Ed, if there's activity, there's been activity on Mars, what about the moon? You know, Ingalls Swan said that he had seen some things on the backside of the moon. What's going on there?
Well, Before I get into that, and I'm speaking rapidly because I'd like to cover as much ground as possible tonight, and there's so much.
You are buzzing along tonight, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I've been in this business 25 years of looking, of observing our observers, and they're not just our observers. There's been intervention as well, too, and we're going to discuss that. But, yes, the moon, we know three things about the moon as remote viewers, and I took some heat in the military unit days for spending a lot of taxpayers' dollars looking at ET UFO, so-called Enigma, right?
Mm-hmm.
But people forget that I wore two hats in the DIA's, Defense Intelligence Agency's Psi Spy unit. I was not just the operations officer because I was only given one UFO-related target in my whole stint there. But I was also the training officer, the unit's first training officer. My job was to take Ingo Swann's discovery of coordinate remote viewing and to massage that into a useful intelligence collection
and
tool.
And train other people. Right?
Roger. And we did, and including my peers, too. So I slipped a Mickey as training officer to blind targets. The students were not allowed to know what these targets were. And, yes, I was there during the transition period where we use altered states, transition into coordinate remote viewing. I was there for that also. So we used both modalities. But I slipped these folks, these viewers, Mickeys, on UFO conducts. But half of those Mickeys that I slipped them were not my own creation. I was approached after hours downtown in D.C. by high-level scientists and others. Harold Putoff was one, Dr. Harold Putoff, who said, okay, Ed, look, this thing happened in Brazil. The Brazilian military went to their government. The government approached us and said, this thing happened in the Bay. It's enigmatic. This is what happened. Can you guys do this? So I used some of those under-the-table events also as Mickeys. Slip in the drinks of my viewers, okay? So I could get away with that because I was also a training officer. Yes, we had to train against known projects because you have to give your students, just like I do in my workshops or in my DVDs, you have to give a student feedback.
That's the only way they can learn.
But if you're training somebody to be an operator, they may never get feedback. They have to be super in terms of training. Just like training somebody, a bomber pilot. The bomber pilot goes to lots of training, releases the bomb or whatever from the aircraft, flies away, gets back to the base, looks at the after-action shots, and sees how close he was, okay? All that's feedback. But in terms of operations, we may never get feedback to something that went down 1,000 years ago or whatever, a flash off the coast of South Africa that satellites could not picked up or were not positioned to do. What was that? Well, we can create it as remote viewers and have. The moon.
The moon.
So right now what we know about the moon is that there are, as has been alluded to by others, there are structures, the shard and other things that are common.
The glass shard, yeah.
Yes. These structures are that we are basically were the result of mining activities. I'd guess millions of years ago. I don't know how far back. And the mining, I don't know what was being mined, but they were very big structures, and the operators were small, kind of like R2-D2 robots. There were no humanoids there, although we suspected occasionally something like that, possibly a carbon-based life form dropped in on them to supervise. But we're not sure. These R2-D2s could have been created by other robots. We're not sure.
Ed, let me ask you this, too. You know, John Lear, who's been on the program before, claims that the moon was towed into position. I do not agree with that. I think it's a natural structure. But what do you think?
Don't know. My job's not to think. Remote viewing is direct knowledge. I've never researched that, George, so I honestly can't. There's nothing I could say about it. There are underground, let's call them parking structures on the moon, where there are small disks that come and go to Earth from those parking structures, let's call them. And we've got good sketches of them. They have pillar supports, rock supports, and they just come and go.
At will?
I don't know. They come to Earth and they go back. Now, what's more interesting to me, though, is on the backside of the moon, what we call the dark side, in a crater, a specific crater, there is a very large cubical layer cake type of geometry structure that is still active. The things on the light side of the moon have been vacated for God knows how long. But on the dark side of the moon, this thing is still operating. We don't know what it does. It's a big, like a building. There's nobody in it. It does something. It's like a transformer or whatever. God only knows. We're talking about technologies that are nominally 100 million years ahead of us. What's even the technology then? And in fact, while we're on the subject, we're dealing with interdimensional or, let's say, quasi-dimensional intelligences. We can't even apply the term technology there, and we'll get into that.
Is it a huge structure?
Yes, it is. Well, I would say it's an office-sized building.
Okay, that's big.
Yeah, yeah. So the Japanese will pick it up, and Clementine already has a Clementine mission. Remember, Clementine was supposed to be NASA, and all of a sudden the Air Force took it over.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Yeah. Will we ever see these kinds of pictures?
Yes, I think we'll see them from Yeah, we'll see them from the Japanese, from other governments, and our government's a little bit reticent for one reason or another. But the key reason is, if a government, a major government, can't explain who bills itself as a leader in science, if it can't explain something, then it's not going to talk about it, because its scientists are supposed to be able to explain any anomaly that big. Not necessarily ghost or something like that, but something like that, they better have an explanation for it. So it's going to take some time to study it before an announcement would be made, but I think the Japanese will beat us to it.
Let's talk a little bit, Ed, about the kill shot. Take some time. And, of course, some of your past remote, which I got to tell you, you hit that Japanese earthquake right on, spot on.
Well, no, it wasn't just the earthquake. It's what the Japanese did not report. I said a major nuclear reactor would break and kill 50,000 to 80,000 people.
That's right.
On. Yeah.
And who knows? How do you keep track of that? I mean, it could be even higher.
Oh, it'll be much higher, unfortunately.
All right, the kill shot. I've been looking at your trailer. You sent us the DVDs a few weeks ago. I got to tell you, first of all, very well-produced program. You know, I spent many years in television. And you did a great job with that.
No, I can't take credit for that. That was Brent Miller Jr. Brent Miller is my partner, runs the entire administrative remote.
You can take a bow once in a while.
Well, as a star, yeah, but this is like race car drivers, too. You know, what's a race car driver without an entire
crew? Without the crew, that's
true.
You
have to have a team.
You know, same with me.
Jumping from Earth's the highest parachute jump as a Baumgartner or whatever, you have to have a crew.
I claim to be the puppet. And my crew is the puppet master. Same kind of thing.
I call God my puppet.
Well, let me tell you. Bottom line is it was very, very well done.
Thank you. I will pass that on to Brent Miller Jr.
And we've talked over many shows about the kill shot. And it is ironic that the sun is starting to do some very peculiar things. I think we've been lucky that some of the flares that have come off the sun weren't facing us directly. Well, we'd be in one heck of a mess.
Yeah, the one that I said 2 weeks before it happened, in I think 2004, was that one was a that would have oh it would have done more than simply take down power grids. It was a very, very dangerous, very serious. In fact, they created a whole new linear, a whole new logarithmic band that they call now a mega flare because of that one flare alone. But we've run out of luck.
Let's get in there. I want to read what you said in March. It says, we're not going to be hit by just one mega solar flare, but a series of them over time, perhaps 1 to 2 years. That's going to turn Earth into a X-ray and proton rotisserie. Locations in the southern hemisphere, such as Australia, over in Africa, will have few survival zones. New Zealand, one possible sanctuary out there. If you aren't in safe haven, then living underground to avoid the high winds and dark skies is your best option. Still believe all that?
Absolutely. No, that's all that's been confirmed by I and my team. Yes, unfortunately.
It's just a matter of when, of which time you cannot predict.
No, but looking analytically, everything is pointing so hugely in so many different vectors that we use to 2013 that I feel a huge sense of urgency, and I'm preparing now to prepare my own myself, because you can't take care of other people unless you take care of yourself, and my family for 2013. In terms of geophysics, in terms of the sun and all that, the other stuff, the socioeconomic, political, military stuff, that's happening as we speak. So that's a different story.
One bright spot, you said, is that there will be ET intervention to help us rebuild after the solar calamity. And then you claim that they have stepped in and have stopped World War III several times.
Yeah, I want to be specific about those kinds of things tonight.
Sure.
We have time, and it's very, very important.
Got lots of time for you, Ed.
Yeah, I have to place these in the context that I have not done before on your show. And now I think your listeners have a little bit of background information, and I'm going to get very specific about things I've never talked about in terms of remote viewing these various entities and things out there and putting them into some kind of what we believe is a perspective. And I'll try my best to do the arrival of, well, I did a contract for Lawrence Rockefeller years ago, and it was entitled Atmospheric Ozone Depletion, Projected Consequences and Remedial Technologies, because he was interested in ozone holes. And what we described in the contract was what scientists don't know is that not only do we have these seasonal holes, thinning of the ozone layer on the poles, both poles, but what they don't know is that Earth's ozone layer is looking like Swiss cheese to remote viewers, and it's metastasizing, to use an anthropomorphic.
That's not good.
No, it's not, because if you check on it, look at how important the ozone layer is to life on Earth, you'll see why it's extremely dangerous. Life on Earth did not really evolve until an ozone layer was created on Earth to stop high-level UVA, ultraviolet rays, too, which break apart peptide bonds and enzymes and all these.
If you've got that Swiss cheese effect, Ed, in the flares or the rays somehow get through the open portions of that Swiss cheese, the area underneath it, directly underneath it, that's what's going to get hit, whether it's a city or an ocean that boils or something like that, isn't it?
No, that's not correct physically, but it doesn't matter. What matters is there'll be a vast heating in the Earth's atmosphere. Lots of water will dry up. We're looking at a barren planet. These
because of all the holes?
No. Not because of the holes themselves, but the actual thinning globally.
Okay.
The thinning. It's really a dangerous thing. These humans, I'm not saying humanoids, we need to discuss this tonight. These humans that pop up, they're humans that were raised on another planet. They were born in tubes of liquid.
Hybrids.
I'm not saying that, George. I did not say hybrids. I said humans.
Am I putting words in your mouth tonight, Ed?
No.
All right.
I don't know if they're hybrids. We're going to discuss this tonight. But anyway, they're raised on another, but their allegiances are to think of it. Think of them as a Federation outreach program. And they're going to be down here, and they're going to help us rebuild the planet. But it's not going to be on our watch, I don't think, George. I think it's going to be at least 50 years out.
Okay. And maybe not on our terms either.
I don't know. But, you know, I'm looking at the now right here, ground truth now, what we can do as people promulgate some information, operators and those things.
Is that what you mean by ET intervention?
No.
It's not.
No, I'm going to get into that.
All right, we'll do that next hour.
Yeah.
All right, you also, again, we talked about the Japanese quake. You were spot on with that in terms of the 50,000 to 80,000 deaths from cancers associated with the fallout. Who knows? That's very conceivable.
Very sad.
Very sad story indeed. You talk about us getting drawn into a war with Iran. That's still a possibility. You still feel that?
It's not feeling, George. It's the reality that Western nations, the United States, for instance, are only the only exports we have now are fiberboard, entertainment industry, and weapons. You and I think you're aware of our weapons exports.
You can
place them against the exports of China and Russia and the big countries, and we outdo them all, too. War is big business, and without that big business, our economy is dead overnight. So, believe me, one thing or another, there's going to be a war. Now, World War III, which I've stated on Coast to Coast years ago, it already started. It's a slow burn. There's not going to be a nuclear slugfest, and we're going to get into reasons why tonight. They have nothing to do with man's decisions, but that's not going to happen because then the business will stop.
And they don't want that to happen.
The U.S. doesn't want it to happen, and the powers
that be don't want it to.
Yeah, the bankers don't want it to happen. The tripartite, the so-called Illuminati, whatever you want to call it, they don't want that to happen. But they, you know.
Here's the interesting thing you've said. You said that unemployment could be up to 40% in a year and a half. So we still have some time when you made that prediction at the end of 2011. But you said it will lead to martial law, possible use of the FEMA camps. And you thought it's possible that the 2012 presidential election could be postponed.
No, I didn't say postponed. I said not happen because of martial law things. I said it's possible that it will never occur because martial law will be declared and the election will be called off.
Period?
Period. That's what I said. That was what I was looking at, you know, over a year ago, too, because martial law is coming. It's coming to this country. You now have a government that's afraid of its citizens.
It's coming to this planet, isn't it?
No, not to countries like Norway and a few others. But it is coming to the U.S.
Well, we shall see, Mr. Ed Dames.
Roger.
Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
Ed's website, learnrv.com, learnrv.com. We're talking about his work, The Kill Shot. And also, he's got one called Learn Remote Viewing. It's a DVD set out there.
George, I'm going to do this again. I have a basic remote viewing workshop in Reno in January 19th and 20th. I'm gonna issue my perennial
invitation. Well, this time, I can assure you I'm in Los Angeles during that month. I've been in St. Louis and all the others, so this one is highly probable.
Yeah, we'd love to see you there. And even if you can't do the daytime thing, I stay with my students until 10 o'clock on Saturday and much later on Sunday nights, and we talk stuff that we can't talk about that are not politically correct, even for your Coast to Coast show there. You might like to join for just simply that.
Your students, they love you in these workshops. As a matter of fact, some of the feedback I've gotten, they say things like, he laughs in some of these events.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember laughing?
No.
Maybe it was afterward. You never know.
I love my work, so I love teaching as well. I hope I can do it for as long as possible, but things are getting dicey.
The Natalie Holloway case. You had felt that she'd be found. She was in something like a some kind of a mesh cage or something.
A lobster cage.
And what do you think about that?
The same as always. As you know, I had an agent underwater in Aruba. We did not coordinate with the FBI. We did not coordinate with the local cops because we mistrusted them. In fact, we even thought they might be involved in the case. He had to stay underwater to get to the site that we had, which was a big problem. We had to use a sled, underwater sled. The GPS readings were very difficult because, as you know, you got to be within a foot of the surface to get a good GPS reading when your GPS is waterproof. And it was a difficult thing, but she's not retrievable. We found her skull way out in the ocean.
Ed, when we come back, let's get into these specifics that you talked about in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got the Major, Ed Dames, tonight, remote viewer. We'll get right into some other things with him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Major Ed Dames with us. Ed, let's get into some specifics now of some of the things you've been working on. And you said one thing, that we've been in the process of a World War III. It just hasn't really popped up yet. What did you mean by that?
No, it has popped up. I just mean it's a slow burn. World War III, we often think of it as a nuclear slug,
right,
those kind of things. But as I've mentioned before, years ago, World War III is a slow burn. It's just a long, continuous fuse with no big nuclear slug. I'm not saying that nukes aren't going to be used, but it's not going to be an earth-changing event in that regard, too, because this planet doesn't belong to us. I think it's an experiment. I think long ago, human DNA was tweaked, and we're not going to be allowed to destroy this kind of garden. I think it's also interesting that, in terms of the subject at hand, that the remote viewers over the last 25 years, and myself as a leader, the program manager, both in the field with the likes of Jacques Vallée and other scientists, sure, we've spent far less time investigating Earth's past and Earth's mysteries than the so-called ET and UFO-associated phenomena, which is very interesting. So one of the things I hope to gain from contact or entry into the Federation, whatever that is a knowledge of who we are and what we are. So that's one of my goals for contact.
If you're allowed in, will it be via remote viewing or will it be physical?
Oh, no, it has to be physical for me. Yeah, I'm a physical guy. The remote viewing stuff, I wouldn't have stuck with it for a quarter of a century if it wasn't fascinating. I'm not usually entertained.
But you bore quickly, Ed.
I do. I spend nowadays, these days and times, I spend a good 50% of my time in the field pursuing remote viewing leads, too. And that's how we got our original Close Encounters of the Second Kind. I was, as you know, the project manager for proprietary scientific projects in the past, out in Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, where we had lots of instrumentation that allowed us to be in a place that we knew was active. Rather than chasing the UFO phenomenon, we could meet it, head it off at the pass. I'm using those terms very loosely because they knew everything that we were doing, of course. But I think it's the biggest mystery of our times, and I'm certainly very enthralled with mysteries. And this is the greatest mystery-solving tool that there is. We had scientific means. I think some of your listeners are familiar with a real thing, the Advanced Theoretical Physics Working Group. That was the cover name for a UFO working group within not just the Department of Defense, but NSA and CIA and other places like that. And I was the youngest member of that group. And we met during the Reagan administration secretly in a sensitive compartment and information facility with all of us had all the clearances in the world to discuss what we each knew, Navy, Army, National Reconnaissance Office, and all that. But we held our cards so closely to our chest for administrative reasons that nothing really came out of that. What we wanted, one thing, we had an agenda. We wanted to determine where we should go, what was the ground truth involved, measurements and all that we had. And we wanted money. But presidents don't have any money. But the Air Force did. General Abramson at the time, just before the downfall of the erstwhile Soviet Union, he had all this money for bringing Pebbles and Star Wars and all that. We were trying to trick the Air Force into giving us money to study this under the rubric of maybe we need to develop software to determine for NORAD when a fast walker was a real Russian missile or a UFO, those kinds of things too, and it didn't work. Because the DOD, as I've said before, and CIA, political economic intelligence, DOD, military intelligence, there was no charter, no license to spend American tax dollars on looking at these things. And yet all of us in this little tight group had these bottom drawers with these very, very interesting things in there where, you know, Air Force, I'll give you one example. I have to be careful. Classified was Air Force plane with five officers on it, lieutenants all the way up to majors, plus the pilots on a monitoring mission. Here comes this thing right up alongside its starboard flank. Lieutenant panics, pulls out his Surface 45, shoots right through the window. No, I'm not kidding. It's a real world situation, and I think it actually got out. And those kinds of things. Well, what happens to those out there in the deep dark world of intelligence? They get shelved because nobody knows what the heck that was. That's why I got out to study this and in terms of business. And the projects that I ran with very prominent scientists in the desert, those were proprietary. They were funded by European royalty, a lot of money. And because they're proprietary, I could never talk to the public and people like you and your listeners about them. So I said, okay, I'm going to stop that, fund these myself, and now I could talk. But I still can't talk about the missions that we did.
Well, tell me about this federation. I mean, are you thinking you're going to be invited into it or what?
No, I have two ideas that I can put. I'll put one in better context momentarily. One is that I think that whatever I try to use in terms of consciousness tools and in the field feedback, whether it's a 50 caliber machine gun interfering with the logistics or whether it's, you know, waving a white flag, knocking on their door and all that, whether or not that has anything to do with it, they're going to be here anyway after the dust settles in about 50 years. That I firmly believe.
If they're not already.
Oh, no, they're here, but they're operating clandestinely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I'm talking about overtly.
Okay.
Yeah, over. I think it was a TV program, Alien Nation.
Uh-huh.
I haven't watched TV since I was 16. I really hate television. But I do remember being in a hotel and seeing a TV program, Alien Nation, where they were actually here and integrated with humans. That kind of thing. And about... way down the road. But right now, before I talk about the more difficult to understand aspects, I will tell you about the here already ones, okay?
Okay.
All right. My focus and my work, classified work, is on a group of humans that operate on the surface of Earth. Now, there are, as I said, there are parking spots underground on the moon, and there's an operations center underground on Mars. There are also parking garages for machines in seamounts, very, very deep in the ocean, very deep in seamounts, too. And these things, they don't really pass through the water, we don't use vehicles in our business. These objects, and not all of them are objects, these things, they pass through the water and they simply materialize in these underground garage, underwater and seamounts garage, parts like that. So there's those kinds of things going on. More importantly, I'm looking at a surface construct where these humans that were not homegrown, came from somewhere else on ships, this galactic project. They are the ones that are responsible for what some of your listeners may have seen on the internet, this plasma type of thing that I'll use these terms loosely. We're very, very strict in our technical work. Fires a beam at a Minuteman missile launch test and sends the missile off course. Have you ever seen this?
Yes, photo? I saw that.
Okay. Well, that's not a physical thing. It's a plasma type of entity that's used as a tool, and that is directed from an above ground command center on Earth. It's not by these humans. They look just like us. They actually have outbound teams. They can defend themselves, but they
speak like us.
They speak any language on Earth because they have to be involved in logistics. They have to have food, energy, electricity for their operations, and other things like that too. But their operation is very, very different, and they are not from here. They're not, and I'm interested in them. But they are in association with something else that is far more esoteric, that has technologies that are beyond our idea of technology. In the early days, 25 years ago, we used to look as remote viewers at these particular things in the sky or whatever, and I termed them transcendental technologies because we had no idea what was going on. There's another agency, and they are not human, and they are not extraterrestrial. They're what I would call extra dimensional. They can be in two dimensions at once if they choose. They're almost invisible. We caught one on camera once, too. In my book, my autobiography, you see me jokingly talk to a Navajo officer, a Navajo policeman, and I say, oh, I'm here from Washington, D.C. to take a break, too. I'm looking for an elephantine amoebic thing that blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, you know what? They look very different than us, and they're very big. And they're very intelligent.
Are these like shadow people or something
else? No, no, no. No, they're not. I have no idea. I wouldn't even know what to call them, these entities. They're not elementals.
But dimensional.
They're in two dimensions at once, it would seem. It's very difficult for us, our thesaurus. And remember, in remote viewing, no matter how disciplined you are in our technique and our skill, you're going, everything exists as a pattern of information. So you're going and you're grabbing a pattern associated with your target or the event that may be your target. You're coming back in a tachycinetic sense from the right brain to the left brain to look for a label in your experience to hang on to this thing. I've used the example many times, and I do in my basic workshop. If one has never experienced the color red before and your training target blind, because you're only giving a set of numbers, as you know, is the Bolshoi Ballet, a Bolshoi Ballet performance and the curtain's red and you're attempting to describe this event. If you've never perceived the color red before, if that's not in your thesaurus, your dictionary, your experience, you have no word label.
You have nothing. That's true.
No. So you have to use something as close as possible. When we are dealing, when we are, as remote viewers, are dealing with these kinds of transcendental, esoteric in some cases, metaphysical in other cases, things, we have to resort to allegory, to analogy, and sometimes metaphor to try to cope with what we're perceiving. And in some cases, it's totally outside our ken. For instance, orbs, this phenomenon of orbs.
Whatever they may be.
Whatever they may be. I'll tell you what, as remote viewers, the best of the best, we can't grab anything. We can't do it. There's nothing we can grab in terms of our cultural evolutionary thesaurus that can suggest what we're dealing with.
But you see them in remote viewing. You just don't know what they are.
We can't get into our dictionary. There's nothing, no common denominator in our experiences, no matter how eclectic. You could be a physicist or a nuclear engineer or a theologist that I've trained many people, types of people. We can't grasp what we're dealing with. That's outside, literally outside our ken. That's not to say that we couldn't be trained, but it may be a factor of not our software, of what we know, but our hardware, our bicameral brain, having evolved in this particular niche of the woods, can't grasp. We don't have the hardware to deal with the associations and the reality of what this is.
Are these entities evil? Are they good?
Are we harking back now to the ones I'm talking about to talk about that are in association with
the dimensional ones?
Yeah, I perceive them as nothing but good. I mean, if you look, if you analyze this outreach program that's attempting to not just forestall, but to prevent, because they know we're all, many UFO types of sightings over the years, and I can get into many of these, they're actually intervention, George, and not just observation. Yes, we as remote viewers are observing them, but they are intervening as well as observing, and they know every single nuclear warhead, hidden, surreptitious or whatever, on this planet. They know where every single one is, and they can neutralize it in a heartbeat. There will never be on this planet, because it's not allowed by something out there, a nuclear slugfest. All of our youth, you're probably not as old as me, but we had to practice these nuke drills under our desks in elementary.
No, I remember that.
Yeah, well, we did it because...
And people had fallout shelters in their little backyards, in their basements.
Well, those may come in necessary now for quite a different reason.
Right.
Because this 11,500-year cyclic big thing that passes through our neck of the woods this time may come as close to us as it did to Mars, although we know it won't be that close because Mars got extinguished.
I want to talk with you about that after the break, but let's get back to these beings or whatever they may be. You're one of the few people who really thinks that they're whatever these things are, that they're good.
I don't. Good is not an objective.
Which doesn't sound like Dr. Doom to me.
I support them.
What do you mean you support them?
I would support anything they're doing. They've been around for a long time. Hyper-intelligent. One of my philosophies is go with a winning team. And I don't know many winning teams anymore, having been at the top of the ladder in terms of esoteric intel, you know, the mystique of intelligence. Well, I've been at the top.
Are they aware that you're aware?
Yes, they are.
They are.
They are absolutely aware. Yeah. And they work in consort with these very human types, too, to do things. For instance, they took the finger off of the nuclear trigger. There would have been a nuclear war twice since 1955 alone.
I believe that.
Yeah, but these guys stopped it. I said, guys, Lucy, these entities stopped it. At the same time, let's say, for instance, I know where this terrestrial facility is. And I decide I want to go there, physically go there, above ground. It's not deep in a mountain or something else like that. It's above ground. And I want to go there. Well, these guys can turn me away. They can take on any. They're the perfect shapeshifters. They can play you like a marionette electronically or otherwise. All the abduction phenomena that we're aware of and that have been reported by our people like John Mack and other greats. They're all these guys are all responsible for that. They have an agenda.
Right.
The Ariel School incident in 1994 outside of Harare, Zimbabwe, where these school children were presented with this UFO and these gray creatures. There are no grays, George. These entities I'm talking about are very visible to the camera. They can present themselves however they want to, and in this particular era, they present themselves as grays and reptilians, you know, because it's just like Hollywood. Keep the interest up.
If they wanted to be aggressive, if they wanted to do harm, could they do that?
Absolutely. That's why it's so funny, your last guest did this conjecture about the E.T. flotilla off the coast there, too. It's just ludicrous in terms of what we know in my team, because they fire a missile at, you know what, at
It's goodbye ships, right?
No.
They wouldn't retaliate?
No. Oh, they could shut down the minds. They could shut down the consciousness of every single individual on board the ships in a moment.
Jeez.
So that nobody would be pushing any buttons.
They wouldn't even have to play around with the ship.
No, and they don't kill. They're not like us. They're not evil.
Well, is this just a different faction? Maybe this is a good one as opposed to some bad ones that are out there?
No, the bad ones that we know of, they're not E.T. UFO related, as far as we're concerned. We could have missed some too. For instance, let's take the idea of jinn. Are you familiar with the Bell Witch? The Bell Witch.
Yeah, hold on, Ed. We're going to hit this break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the Bell Witch, and I also want to get into these solar flares when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, the coasttocoastam.com website is now iPad compatible, so go have some fun if you have an iPad and do whatever you do. And we'll be back in a moment with Major Ed Dames on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back to Coast with Major Ed Dames. Ed, you were talking about some analogy with the Bell Witch story. I'll let you fill
in. Yes, I was saying that these other entities that are probably these transcendental entities that are probably responsible for us not annihilating ourselves to date. They're very different. They're not. I call them extra dimensional, but we have picked up one on camera, and we know that it allowed us to. They're very. They don't exist in another dimension, and they're very different than ghosts or any supernatural thing, like jinn, for instance. The Bell Witch, which is probably the most documented supernatural event in North American history, one of my professional development students was very interested in it. So as a practicum, we took a look at it. And then I became interested in it and personally wanted to look at where the Bell Witch, which has not really manifested itself, or that phenomenon has not manifested itself in a while, I investigated it too. It exists now, presently, present time, as a point above the ground in a desert area. In essence, it's in another dimension. And there are at least 11 or 12 dimensions out there that science are aware of now. But they exist in another dimension where it can pop into this one, do what it did, which is extremely interesting. Even General Sherman ran away.
And then pop out again.
And pop out again, too. And so if we wanted to study the circumstances under which it, or things like ghosts, which are energy patterns, mind patterns out there, we wanted to study those for scientific purposes, that would be good. But time's running out. Life is short. And I don't have any more time for djinn. The djinn.
The djinn.
Yeah.
Which the Arabs, of course, feared. They were like genies, weren't they?
Yes, and I can see now after my student brought this to my attention and what went down there too. I'd be running too.
All right, look, Ed, we're coming up to the Mayan calendar date, December 21st, 2012. Solar flares. Do we see anything there, or is it beyond?
I've mentioned before, I don't see any correlation, any correspondence.
None.
Very much, very similar, analogous to the Y2K situation.
Yep.
Where. Art Bell asked me if there's anything there. I said, we see nothing, Art. And the Mayan calendar, the same thing. No correlation whatsoever with what we're perceiving date-wise. However, in 2013, different story. Different story. And I'm beginning to be a believer because some of my students are starting to track a very big object, which they feel is this thing that I've described that passes close by between the Earth and the Sun. The beginning of the track, that I'm starting to become a believer in Planet X. I just don't have time to look at it, but my students are tracking something big.
Do you assign the students, or are they on their own now?
No, they're on their own now. They're pros. I train them. They're off. And they're off and running. They're doing a fantastic job. If you want to meet them and see their projects, one of the projects is they're fascinating projects. The things I used to do when I was in my younger days when I had time, go to learnrv.com and go to the forums and look at advanced projects. And if you're a new student, a new remote viewing student, whether you learn at a workshop or through the DVDs, all the help's there. I'm there every day. They're there every day, and it's all free. All the advanced stuff is there. But the advanced project section is very sexy. It's extremely fascinating. And these guys are pros, too, just like me. They're my peers now. I train them. They have the experience that they need, and they are now my peers.
So we may not have the solar flares now, but you are convinced they're going to keep coming and possibly over a 1 or 2 year period. Bang, bang, bang. Like that?
I don't know what the period will be. All I'm doing is feeling afraid of 2013. Because it's the top of the solar cycle there, too, and even scientists are chewing their nails on this one.
What do you recommend people do?
Well, it's the same as always.
Run.
you need to know where to go, though. Even if you got to have a place to run to, if you live in, especially if you live in the cities where things will be off the shelves really quickly, and water might go down, no gas pumps work, that kind of thing. You need to know where to go, so you have to identify that first too. I do. I don't have much time to do it anymore. Right? I've done many, many personal contracts with personal sanctuaries where your unconscious works with the matrix to show you where its form fits your personality to where you need to be during this kill shot sequence. The major thing is it can't be in a metropolitan area with some exceptions. For instance, Christchurch, New Zealand, has suffered this devastating earthquake that leveled the city. That actually happens to be a kill shot survival zone because citizens are ready for anything at any time. And they're an educated society. It's not like L.A. or Oakland or Detroit or Chicago or New Orleans, where in 6 hours if things go down, there's riots in the streets and people are raping your wife and the kids and things like that. Uh-uh. You have an educated society. So So there are many many elements that go into this, these survival zones. The bunker mentality, no, doesn't work. You're gonna run out of ammo. You're gonna run out of food.
You're gonna run out of water.
You're gonna, well, maybe not. Not if you live near a road. But you may need a doctor or a dentist. Abscess tooth will kill you. So people need other people. So that's a criterion too. But water and food are the big one. So a lot of these areas have fresh water and fish, because we're looking at not only xeric conditions, very dry, lots of water. That's what's going to kill most of the people in this kill shot scenario, is the lack of water in the short term. Many people die from drought conditions, because not just directly from dehydration, but from not having food to eat.
Wars over, Ed? Wars over water?
No, not until about a year or so into the kill shot sequence, where nobody cares about fighting anymore. And as I've said, all the warring parties go home.
Well, because will this be a Mad Max society?
Yes. Yeah. Except for people in these survival zones. And again, there's educated, there are people in the places. There are some places in Norway, still some places in New Zealand, very few spots in the world where got a society that is very educated, and they're not barbaric. But for the most part, and in fact, even in terms of the contact imperative that I'm concerned with, I think that we need to give the keys back to dad for the car, because if we rebuild our society, we'll still make the mistakes that we did. We need to act as intelligently as possible to elicit contact. That's my second criterion. I want to see if using consciousness tools, which appear to be a lingua franca for the Federation, for intelligences out there of many different shapes, sizes, and forms, some possibly or really unfathomable to us and nevertheless intelligent, we need to display intelligence to become members, entry-level members to this federation. Having said that, I'll hark back to what I said earlier, that they're coming here anyway, and we will have contact whether we want it or not. There's one wild card.
What is that?
Bigfoot.
Bigfoot?
Bigfoot is a big wild card to me. The Bigfoot, as I mentioned on your shows before, Bigfoot is it's an extraterrestrial, but it's an avatar. It lives these entities, intelligent entities. What was the Han Solo partner?
Chewbacca.
Chewbacca. Yeah, these Chewbaccas, they live on a very cold, barren planet. They appear to come here. They may come here for some type of emergency thing, but all that we've managed to put together over the last 20-plus years are, it looks like recreation, that they're teleported here, using very sophisticated technologies, for a few hours, sometimes longer, just to be here. I don't know how much they pay for this, so, and then what the currency, fiat or otherwise, but they just to be here. But they're avatars. They are what James Cameron would call avatars. They have masks while they're here. They leave footprints and all that. It's, even the best trackers in the world walk up and find their tracks just stop. They have been seen to be walking under in streams and under the water and all that because they can. Because they're not. And that's why you'll never shoot one. You'll never shoot one or travel. They're avatars. And we know a lot about the mechanics, basic mechanics of their transport mechanisms and their world in terms of the physics. I certainly could not come close to the physics of understanding how they actually, let's call it beam, for lack of a better word, down here and back up.
That's amazing. So of all these things that you've done over the years, in the old saying, these are the best of times, the worst of times, are you glad that you're around right now?
Oh, absolutely. And I would like to, you know, I'd even be willing to start a new family because life goes on. And, yeah, it's some, I just feel fortunate. I feel absolute gratitude, that's all. And I'm a very spiritual man, yeah. We talk a lot about ETs and UFOs things too, but you know I'm a firm believer in angels and
God. Oh, I know that. God. You know, every time that we're together, the times we've met, I mean, you don't come across in person as Dr. Doom.
I had a role to play. I was hated in the military. I told Mike the command. I was the first first electronic warfare officer of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Division, the one that went in and kicked the first Iraq War. And my job was to tell the commander what to expect in case the Russians, the erstwhile Soviets, came across to fill the gap and all that. I said, here's the way it's going to start. For the Spetsnaz undercover agents are going to lob VR-55 grenades, nerve gas grenades, into the schoolyards where our kids, the troops that are stationed overseas, at lunchtime are playing and nerve gas the kids. That's going to buy them a couple of hours of grief, and that couple of hours is worth it. And my commander would look at me and say, you're sick, James. You're sick. Because nobody wants to know the truth. Because at that time, dialectic materialism cared less about spirit, soul, and death and all that. And a war is an excuse for anything. But even my commander, who was a Vietnam veteran, and I came in the Army at 17 as a paratrooper, airborne infantry, too. Even they didn't want to. They thought I was sick because I told them the way it is, because the Russians think at the time differently. It's a different world. Our cultural conditioning is a prison for us. Even our language is a prison, too, and we don't realize it's prison that we're in. But the heart is not in prison, only our minds, and we did it to ourselves.
Well, we sure did, Ed. We sure did. But we're in the middle of it now, and we got to make it work.
And we're not going to make it work, George. There's not enough of
that's the old Dr. Doom.
We're not going to make it work. We're going down. We're going down for the count.
Yeah, but you're still hopeful. Is this going to be like a cleansing?
And I don't give it any anthropomorphic terms. It just is. It's just we've made choices corporately, ourselves. We've made choices. Mankind has made choices. Not all of us wanted to make those choices, but the majority of us did, so we have to be responsible for ourselves. And we made some bad choices, but life is a big classroom. So as long as we learn from them, which it appears that we have not, we're going down.
Ed, we reported years ago, but it was confirmed several weeks ago, that the military sprayed people in St. Louis, testing them biologically with chemicals and all kinds of things. Do you still see those pandemics occurring? Combinations of...
I think that's a non sequitur, George, the military testing and pandemics. Pandemics I would be glad to talk about, but in terms of the military testing, I cannot talk about, because as some of your listeners know, I happen to be this nation's top biological warfare case officers. I mean, we're way up there at the top, and I know about all those historic things and things that... Maybe I can say one thing.
I was going to say, you can't say it or you won't say it.
No, George, it's still classified. Yeah. But I think I can say one thing. I'm willing to say one thing, whether I've taken the chance or not. You know how the U.S. granted a sort of a clemency to the erstwhile Nazi rocket scientist.
Yes, Project Paperclip. Right? They brought them all over here.
Yeah, well, what is lesser known is we did the same thing to Japanese biological warfare scientists, Unit 13, 713, that did horrible, horrible things to Japanese and American, to Chinese and American prisoners in China. Horrible, horrible things, testing biological agents that were under design to be used as offensive weapons. Horrible things. And when we captured them, we did the same thing that the U.S. government did with their counterparts, their German scientists, rocket scientist counterparts. We gave them clemency in return for all their knowledge about how American prisoners suffered when they were injected with these various things, those kinds of things like that. And this stuff's still classified, not to mention the tests that have been done on American citizens.
I know. Why would they do that?
Well, I can understand. You can't, maybe can't, but I can. I was on the inside, and
there's no excuse.
No, that's not it. When you've been conditioned to believe that mission is everything, then you reach a point, I did as a young captain, military intelligence captain, where screw the whales, screw the civilians, heck with all this, you know, we need to accomplish the mission, the threat needs to be countered and all that. That's the mentality that you become acculturated with. I was there, and so I can understand why. Okay, even we need to test this, and I could talk weeks about how, you know, all these kinds of things. You aerosolize a particular test, so-called neutral E. coli thing, disseminate it in a subway system somewhere in New York or wherever. Then you test it and you watch people to see what the effects were, all that. To use that as a baseline metric when you develop the real thing to use it against the enemy.
That's possible.
Uh-huh.
Our guest, Major Red Dames, his website, learnrv.com. Go take a look at the trailer of The Kill Shot, which is at coasttocoastam.com as well. And that DVD's ready to go right now, isn't it, Ed?
Of course. Yeah, it's been out there, too. And our manufacturers and our producers, they get paid. I think there's a shipping cost. I can't remember what it is, too, but that covers my producers and our manufacturers. That's all.
I mean, it's got enough quality where I thought it would have been on one of the network TV shows.
I have no time for TV, George.
I know you don't even do that, do you?
No.
So you've not watched us on Ancient Aliens? You've missed that, haven't you?
No, I don't watch any TV. I surf the web frequently. When I'm not in the field, I'm on. I do look at it. I keep up with the news. But not entertainment.
I mean, can you remote view a presidential election? Do you do that?
Yes, and we've done it before too. But it's sort of an over the horizon thing. If that event already exists in time, and many events do, large events do, then we can pick it up and it's correct. But sometimes, for instance, during the Clinton that particular election, out of 6 months out, we could not pick up the winner. We could only end our results of the next presidential election. Winner was a person. We would draw a person sitting in a living room somewhere watching television. And to us, we know that those kinds of things mean that the decision has not been adjudicated yet, too. It has to be decided, and a point is usually reached within about 6 weeks of an election where it's a fait accompli. It's done. You can remote view it too. This is very different than big strategic events like Armageddon, apocalypse, a war, a kill shot, a tsunami, or something like that. Very, very different. That's why I think the prophets, the real biblical prophets, could see things out thousands of years, because these events that they were foreseeing were so huge that they loomed so big in terms of human consciousness and the matrix as a pattern.
Ed, we're going to take some time next hour, continue chatting with you, but we're going to take some phone calls as well. You're next with Major Ed Dames on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Major Ed Dames with us, Dr. Doom, some would say. We'll take your phone calls with him when we turn the corner next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Ed Dames. Your phone calls, of course, this hour. Ed, we're talking about the upcoming elections and what remote viewers can or cannot see. Is it easy or is it difficult to see into the, you know, month or two ahead?
Well, seeing is a misnomer. Actually, we put together a jigsaw puzzle of the answer. We have to ask or articulate the question the right way and then go through all these steps, these piano playing steps that we go through to come up with the answer. So if we have the right question formalized and articulate it correctly, it's pretty easy to discern whether or not an answer is out there and which one it is. For instance, there are shortcuts, if I can give you an example.
Sure.
Hillary Clinton was running in the vice presidential position in the former election. So we just one of the shortcuts we have, rather than it's a long elaborate story, but we could describe the anatomy, the actual a part of the anatomy of the vice president of the winner of the election. And when it turned out not to look like it looked like a female, then but just by deduction, we
sure
say, okay, so
it's not her,
right? So that's a shortcut. Otherwise, we have other things too. We can describe the person's family, personal aspects, and things like that to adjudicate and analyze who the winner is, if that's been decided by the masses yet.
One of the things you've told us over the years, Ed, is that in remote viewing, if people want to try to practice this, you can't really think too much. You just have to let it happen, right?
It's a three-part process. No. You can't just let it happen. This is a structure that is music, as sheet music. It happens the moment you decide what piece to play, and the sheet music in front of you, and then you start. That's the structure, and you can't think about the next note that you played. So it's a very much analogous to playing a musical piece, where you read, you play each note, and don't think about the one you just played, the next one that you need, and then if that's done correctly, and you didn't think at all, then the piece is played correctly. It's a three-part process: setting up the formal matrix search term. Number two is the skill itself, which is not difficult to teach. In about 6 months, you can become pretty skilled in remote viewing. And then the third part, you put your thinking cap back on again and analyze your data. So, but during the process itself, no thinking allowed. And it's because it's, as a coach, when we teach, when I teach as students do, of course we teach you how to recognize when your imagination is affecting. Psychics can't do this. Psychics don't know when their imagination is
takes over. That's right.
Yeah. We teach you how to know when that's happening.
Before we go to calls, Ed, you talked about crop circles, that they were sending these to us almost like
calling cards.
Yeah, exactly. Why do they make it so difficult for us to understand what the heck they mean?
They don't mean anything. We thought they did in the past. We thought that they meant something, but they don't. They simply are meant to attract our attention. They're very much like the idea of the 2001 Space Odyssey monolith, where we discover that because we've reached a certain degree of technological performance, and then we go from there and use that as a jump-off point too. My perspective about crop circles is that they're calling cards. And there's no way to know what they are without these advanced human consciousness tools, because this is the next frontier. Technology can go so far. I'm not impressed with technology. I've seen so much stuff out there, but consciousness, mind is the final frontier. Uh-huh. Consciousness tools can see, not look at what these are, because when we look at crop circles themselves, we can't really download anything of significant value in terms of intelligence about what they are. But when we look at how they're produced, we can see the physics behind them, which I described on the show before. But more importantly, we can see their makers. Who's behind this? And we always go back to this underground thing on Mars, which for all intents and purposes could act like the monolith in 2001 Space Odyssey. Once we knock on that door, Katie barred the door, figuratively speaking, no pun intended. Who knows where we go from there?
Who knows? To the phones we go. Let's go to Matt in Hercules, California to get us started. Go ahead, Matt. You're on with Major Dames.
Oh, hey. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I was just calling because I'd like to provide share what I think is going to initiate the kill shot. And I believe that ultimately, I agree with Edgar Cayce, that I think it's going to be a human consciousness that is going to trigger the kill shot. Let me explain why I think that's going to happen. If billions of people on the Earth can't stop a couple thousand bankers and their puppet masters from, enslaving us, we don't deserve intervention. And I think that's why they're taking the observer kind of a role so far, except for when they talk about, disarming the nukes and stuff. And mm-hmm. So what I think is going to happen is, I'm not necessarily a religious person. I believe that the role of like Jesus and martyrs is to serve, nice conversation and get the discussion going, whether people believe it or disagree with it. The conversation has been going on since it happened. And so what I believe is going to happen in the future is that an event's going to happen, and I believe it's going to be to a man because we're a man-based society. Not that women aren't worthy. It's just that it's just the ego of how globally we're kind of ran. And so I think perhaps it'll happen in a couple of years where we're wearing devices like a Google headset where people can tune into their friends like an app, and you can see and smell and hear and feel like, what's going on.
Like you're right there. But how does this all tie into the kill shot?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I was going to get there right there right now. So what happens is an event's going to happen, and people are going to be able to instantly tune in and see something that's happening. And then at that instant, all the conversations, it's going to come to fruition. And I'm not sure, the science of it.
All right. Well, let me let you jump in here for a minute, Ed. You know, we're through this social networking right now. That's growing by leaps and bounds. Do you see that as affecting anything towards society in the future?
I do. I do, of course. I'm concerned about the ego thing. I know that knowing myself and knowing my past and who I was, who I am now, if I were a young person, for instance, just speaking for myself, there I would be the same as any other teenager, and my ego would try to express my, I would want a sense of autonomy. When I was a young man, I wanted to stand out. I took my first parachute jump on my 16th birthday, and now, you know, big man on campus for a week or so. Things like that. So I understand those things. And but I think we're losing our sense of spirituality. Our technology and our egos are outrunning our spirituality. So that's my fear, and that's all I want to say about it.
Let's go to our Skype caller in Japan. Kota is with us. Hi there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Nori, Major James. Major James, last time you were on the show, you were talking about the next nuclear crisis in Korean Peninsula. And as you know, and as I have talked to George about a month ago, the tension over here in Japan, the relationship, and increasing unbelievable tension between China and Korea. I mean, all of us are in total uneasiness.
As a matter of fact, China moved some of its warships your way just today toward those islands.
Mm-hmm. And the U.S. Navy has deployed their fleet as well, too, a couple of days ago.
All right, Ed, care to comment about all that?
I think Japan will become one of the saddest cases in the history of our civilization.
Want to elaborate on that?
Well, Fukushima is going
to—is
affecting all of almost all northern Japan.
That's true.
Kyoto is beautiful, and southern Japan is still relatively safe. But in terms of the economy of Japan and society, I think Japan may cease to exist economically soon, and culturally, I think it will be spread around Asia and Southeast Asia.
If there was conflict with China, there's no way Japan could win that, is there?
No.
No, they don't have really an army anymore.
Well,
they?
Remember that the U.S. has agreements.
Yeah, with Japan to protect too,
and
them.
And then we get really complex.
As we do with Taiwan as well.
Correct. Yeah, so I think...
well, and I think China's got
its... trading material there, too.
I think China's got its eyes on those areas.
China's playing with a full deck. China, as I've mentioned before on your show, as an intelligence officer, not in the technical intelligence arena, but the human intelligence arena, we noticed that the former East Germans had 5-year plans, the Americans had 1-year plans, the Chinese have 50-year plans.
Yeah,
I'm not kidding.
No, you're right.
We're going to wake up one day and it's over, and they already know this, and it's almost over too. Economically, the same thing that happened to the erstwhile Soviet Union. Will happen to us, and the Chinese are playing their hand well. Yes, they have internal problems. Yes, I'm aware of their booms and busts and things like that too. But I'm also aware of lots of other things. They're the winners in this next go round.
Yeah, that's true too. How could they have so much patience? How can they wait that
long? Oh, they do. When I was a young man living in Japan and China, when I studied martial arts in China as a young man, a young soldier, and many Chinese martial arts masters would not teach Americans because we were so quick to anger, number one. And number two, you had to practice, for instance, in kendo, just drawing a sword, drawing and striking with the same thing, or just practicing some thing like a reverse punch for 6 months. Americans said, I'm out of here, because Americans wanted it now. They wanted the black belt now. And they were, you know, whereas the Chinese are hyper patient, super patient. I used to walk my dog in a bamboo forest in the mountains, secretly from a distance, watch the Shaolin priest, you know, go through their motions. It was poetry, it was magic, it was music, and I learned a lot about patience. But I don't have any.
None yet. Let's go to Tyler, Chicago, Illinois, first time caller. Hi, Tyler.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
Ed, it's great to speak to you, man. I've been listening to you for a while. A couple of questions for you, but first off, I have to agree with you. I think our technology has far outweighed our humanity, and I think that's probably one of our biggest downfalls. But one of my questions was these extra-dimensional beings, that I actually kind of agree with you on that. Do you think that all the extraterrestrial contact that we have, or people, you know, the sightings that everybody sees, do you think that they're all these extra-dimensional beings, or do you think that there are also, you know, extraterrestrials out there that have contacted us as well?
No, many of the things are extraterrestrial nature. They're extraterrestrial nature. Some of them, the ones I talked about that are essentially interdimensional or extra-dimensional, let's look at the Gulf Breeze example, for instance, where people stand on the shore and look at these things in the sky, these things loosely, because let's just say lights. In this case, they really were objects, but we don't use objects and vehicles and craft in our business, in our technical business. But you stand on the shore one night and you see this thing for, let's say, 5 minutes, from 7 p.m. to 7:05 p.m., and it flashes out. Then you get on the beach the next night, and there it is again. This looks like the same thing in a little bit different position for 5 minutes, and flashes out. It's moving through time. These things can travel through time. They've mastered this too. You're seeing it moving through time from day to day, from night to night, from your perspective as well. And those things, you know, many of them are extraterrestrial observers from places that we don't know about, because we haven't taken the time to study them.
How did and we've talked about this before, but for new people, how did the title Dr. Doom come about?
At one point in my military career, I, especially as a biological warfare case officer, but also as an Enigma working group guy in DOD, I had to brief at the old executive office building on something called the DeRose Circuit. I had to brief as a representative of the U.S. Army and to the President of the United States and the executives. And all the Air Force guys and others would brief about megatonnage and throw weights, how many megatons this Russian missile had or whatever, those kind of things. And then when I got out there, I said, okay, so what the Russians are doing now, they're taking Naja oxyana, a cobra toxin venom, taking that protein and having E. coli that's found in our gut, that particular organism, elaborate upwards of 45% of its body weight and develop that and excrete it too. So if they spray this on a submarine crew from the opposite pier where the sub just departs, about 48 hours later after the sub is at sea, the entire crew would feel like they're being bitten by an Indian cobra in their stomach, and they will all become incapacitated, and that sub is useless. And so that got the attention of folks there who became very bored and fell into an ennui when they heard another word about megatons. That's how I got the nom de guerre.
And you had it for a long time. Do you like that title now?
No, I don't care. I think it's appropriate. I think people need to come out of the head's got to come out of the sands. You can stay there if you want to, but there's a price to be paid. Naivete has a price.
Ed, just take a moment. Tell us where we can get the kill shot. Can we get it straight off your website? How do you get it?
You can go to the Coast to Coast page tonight, or go to learnrv.com if you want to sign up for workshops or learn anything more. And I would highly encourage anybody that's interested to go into the RV forums where I'm at and my pros are at doing, ask questions, take a look at our work. Yeah, it's boring, about as boring as Monte Carlo theory and any other form of mathematics, but its results are highly important in terms of, in terms of accuracy and systematism. LearnRV.com.
You got it. LearnRV.com. We're with Major Ed Dames. If you need to email me, by the way, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. I'll be back in just a moment. I'll tell you what's in store on our next Coast to Coast show, and we'll wrap things up with final phone calls with the Major. So those of you who are on hold from Las Vegas, Wisconsin, Atlanta, and all over the place, you just hold on for a second. But I did promise that I would go back to one more caller before we get to the break. Mark in Las Vegas, Nevada. Go ahead, Mark.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, I was listening to what he was talking about, and I totally disagree, because starting December 21st is the beginning of the fifth age, the age of Aquarius, the age of woman, the age of the five-pointed star, the fifth age, and it's the age of idea. We're at the end of the age of material, where all that mankind has ever wanted to do here is conquer and rule and have more than the other. And look what I got. Look what you don't have.
That hasn't stopped either.
Right, exactly. The age of idea will start December 21st. The idealists. And so, like, when someone's has been with the government or does things with the government wants us to be afraid. So they install this fear in us. But we're not to be afraid, because the age is going to be better. Everything's going to get better. It's not going to get worse. Let's look back. What's the worst thing that happened? Towers got hit by some planes. Well, let's go back to the Holocaust. That was way worse. There was a lot way more worse things. And these three entities, the government, the secret societies, and religion, all three of them do one thing. They make sure to keep women out. Because the reason why they keep women out is because when women are equal completely with all men, the sacred secret will be revealed. I wrote a book called The Secret and the Truth of the Ages, and it reveals what the sacred secret is. Once we all figure out what the sacred secret is, we will all become united again. We'll be free again, and we will all be a utopian society like we were.
Let's hope it's sooner than later, Mark. Let's hope it's sooner than later. We're going to come right back and take some final phone calls here, and thank you for holding so long, Mark. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Major Ed Dames on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Jim Elvidge joins us as we'll talk about the universe solved. A little bit of science for you on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back with Major Ed Dames, let's wrap things up with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, back with Major Ed Dames, and of course your phone calls as well here on Coast to Coast AM. Ed, can everyone remote view once they're trained?
Oh, absolutely. It's just like any other skill, George, playing the piano, ice skating, shooting, whatever. The only difference that I've noticed in my career is that people possess natural talent, really good psychic energy,
right,
their birthright. They can become really all-stars rather than pros. But in my team, in my actually operational team, there are no prima donnas, because just like in the military, we operate as a team.
Okay, let's take final calls. Keith in Montana, west of the Rockies. Hey, Keith, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
This is Keith in Montana.
Good
one of
have
your former
you.
Students.
Yeah, I remember you well.
I thought so. Hey, I was wondering, I'm working on finding people's personal sanctuaries, and have you figured out how to do the locations like you were talking about with Brent?
Yes, most of my time in the field is actually practicing that, but precision down within 30 feet, not just a few miles. But not for sanctuary. Sanctuary locations are generally...
What is a sanctuary location?
It takes your own unconscious in combination with the matrix, a collective unconscious, and it form fits that plus your personality to a geographical location that's best for you to sit out the effects of the kill shot. And it can be very different between, let's say, a husband and wife. One person may like cold weather, one person not. And what your unconscious does, it knows ahead of time where you should go. Unconscious is your best friend. It's chief priority is to keep you alive. But in terms of your unconscious, it can also, you know, maintain not just life, but quality of life, too. So personal sanctuary work deals with that, where to go to sit out, the best place to sit out the kill shot.
How does it work, Ed? What is this interconnection, wirelessly, of course, that makes people remote view, that gives them these impressions, that basically lets them see without eyes?
We don't know. We would have to understand human nature and consciousness itself, too. We're practitioners. I'm like a test pilot. That's what I was in the military. You take this thing that was discovered, in my case, by Ingo Swann, the father of remote viewing, and fly it. Crash and burn it. Pick yourself back up. Let's fix that. Crash and burn it again. Let's fix that. Do that over 25 years, and it evolves. Now you're flying a space shuttle instead of just an F-15 or a biplane. But we leave it to the – I'm a practitioner. I'm a technician, an operator, an observer. We're going to have to leave it to the academicians and the scientists to figure out how we're able to do this, if they ever can at all, because that's not my job. But I'm approached many, many times by brilliant physicists. In fact, my youngest son is a brilliant physicist too. I'm approached by them, and they sit down with me and say, okay, how are you guys able – what you're saying is you're able to perceive things – and events that are outside what we call the light cone. Many of your physicists out there will understand what I mean. How are you able to do that? And I say, hey, you go figure it out. I'll tell you what we do. You come back to me. I'll give you some more info. You figure it out. But I have a job to do.
Let's go to Frank, Janesville, Wisconsin, wildcard line. Frank, go ahead.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure, Frank.
And thanks for your service to our country, both of you.
Thank you.
Major, while you guys were eating steak in the officer's mess, I was eating SOS with the grunts.
I don't know why. I was an airborne infantryman an enlisted scum for 7 years.
You had a taste of the dust, didn't you?
Roger.
Not me, though, Ed. I was an officer from the get-go.
I know. Officer and a gentleman.
Ed, you should feel very blessed.
I definitely feel
blessed. The entities that you encountered were called watchers.
Yes. They're called by many people.
They've been keeping us out of trouble for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. They have a boss, and his name is Yeshua. He's also known as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords.
If I were off air, I would agree with you.
Those watchers have been having a heck of a time keeping us straightened out.
That must be a lot of work for them. Are they like angels, Ed?
Almost. But not quite. For instance, they've been a lot of the religious-related, Christian religion-related events in Christian history that have been attributed to angels are actually not angelic in nature. They are these entities, because angels can't interact with physical reality. Very difficult for them to punch into this dimension, where these things are. Or I say extra-dimensional, they can swing back and forth between wherever they're at, and again, we've caught them on camera, and actually affect physical things.
Let's go to Edwin, Atlanta, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Hey, Edwin, go ahead.
Hey, Major James.
Hi.
Hey, the question I wanted to ask you is, have you ever tried to remote view the John Teeter story?
John Teeter, of course, being the time traveler.
Yes. No, I have not. I have not. There is one incident at CERN where I don't know if you guys know about this, but this one guy was picked up at CERN trying to do something, and he's put in a cell and disappeared from the cell. I wish I had time to take a look at that. I mean, that's the story.
Like, poof, disappeared? They don't know where he is?
They put him in the cell. He popped up in CERN inside the gates and was saying he was a time traveler and don't do this and don't do that. They put him behind in a cell behind a lock and key, and next morning he was gone.
Have you remote viewed inhabited planets that, you know, have major cities?
Yes. And there's one I'll never forget, a very beautiful world with humanoids, because there's a lot of planets that have other things, very, very, very different than you and I. But there was one that's humanoid, and it had a beautiful layout, a circular layout of one particular city that had these rings, these concentric rings, but it went down in the cone shape down below because its very atmospheres are very very unpredictable. And so if you below surface, things are much more stable, as you know. So it went down conically, but it was still circular in nature, too. And I looked at all the ergonomics and the chairs and things like that. But the one thing I will never forget is, I don't know if you say this on the radio, but it's a very intimate thing. I was watching a male and a female engage in intimacy and how their hands and fingers touched first and what they felt. I stopped the session. I almost cried because it made me feel like an animal, an absolute hair-covered barbarian. I had never experienced anything or believed anything could be so intimately beautiful in my life, and I really felt like a primitive ape. Really.
Jay in Bay City, Michigan. Hey, Jay, go ahead.
Hey, I've been listening for years, and remote viewing, you've never really said what it is. I mean, I don't mean how you do it, but define it. What is it?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, actually, because we get asked that all the time. There's no common denominator to describe what remote viewing. It's an attention management skill. It's an intelligence collection tool and all of that. But until you learn this, you don't know what it is. It's just an it. You have to be able, you have to learn it. Even the rudimentary stuff that our first DVD teaches you in a matter of hours what this is in practice, and you say, so this is what it is. But unlike, let's say, ice skating, where you put these blades on a chute that are in shoes on your feet and you slip across this icy surface, if you want to learn how to ski, one could say analogously, hey, it's like ice skating. You put these things on your feet, and instead of ice, you slide down a snowy surface, too, like that. There's no common denominator. There's nothing out there to show you what remote viewing is like. That's why you have to learn it in order to know what it is, period. Go to learnrv.com, take a look around, and see if there's anything there you like.
Do you think the government should be doing this again like they did with you and the others?
Absolutely. They watch me closely because they know that if I'm there in a pinch, if they need me to. But like I say, the Chinese are pulling ahead, and not just pulling ahead. They're pulling ahead in our sister science, too, telekinesis, psychokinesis, the Geiger-Geller effect. And that's going to bite us. That's going to get us. They don't have any politically correct prescriptions
against
these kinds of things. We do.
Let's go to Elisa, Oregon we go. Hello, Elisa.
Hi, George.
Hey.
Hi, Major Danes. I have a two-part question.
Sure.
First off, you had mentioned something about people that are like intuitive or have sort of psychic abilities would do better at picking up the remote viewing. I was wondering
the other way around.
Yeah, in a given period of time, they produce about twice as much detail than somebody like me who is born an average psychic.
Okay, next.
Okay, well, where does meditation ability, does that come into play viewing?
No, alpha state remote viewing is a high theta state in terms of brain states. Let's say the best yogis that we know of in Tibet, they're in pure alpha when they meditate, and that's diametrically opposite than the high theta state to win. Theta state, if you're driving down the freeway and you're kind of in a daze and you forget about the last 10 miles that you drove, you are in a theta state. And meditation is very different. It's an alpha.
When a remote viewer starts to sketch some of the things he sees or she sees, are they doing it, or is there some entity out there that's controlling it?
No, George. No, it's purely an individual thing. It's absolutely individual. You're not channeling. There's nothing taking over your body. It's you, and you're not going anywhere. And in terms of a holographic universe, it's all inside of you. You know, you're just turning your attention to something like a radio, tuning in and decoding. That's all you're doing. It takes the autonomic nervous system is responding to an unconscious signal that's in connection with a pattern somewhere. That's the connection right there, and that's how your sketches go.
Logan in Oklahoma City, you're on Coast to Coast in California, Oklahoma City, I take it. Go ahead, Logan.
Hey, this nice to talk to you, Major Dames and George Norrie. Talked to George a few times, and I just was curious thought of the possibility of something that Dr. Rick Strassman poses, who's he had experimented with a drug called DMT with a bunch of people, I think, in the, maybe the 90s or sometime. Anyhow, he proposed that maybe some of these solar flares, which could affect the pineal gland and the release of DMT and melatonin, that possibly if there was an intense one, intense enough on the, around the 21st or later this year, possibly it could send the globe into like a simultaneous DMT trip slash rapture event sort of thing, you know, maybe. And I guess I'll take your answer off there.
I don't know. I mean, there's so many things I don't know. And there's so many things out there. There's so many things. I guess they'll all become clear when I die. But I don't know this. I only know what I know. I'm a specialist in a very narrow field, albeit very interesting to most of us in this particular culture. But I just don't know about that.
A few minutes to go here. We'll take final calls. We've got Calvin truck driving in Missouri on the wild card line. Hi, Calvin. Go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, sir.
Okay, I wanted to kind of comment on a few things that people were talking about. As humans, we are limited by the things that we are taught growing up. Now, that's only because sometimes the people that teach us don't know a lot of things, or they just haven't experimented enough to take the time to learn their brain.
Cultural now, conditioning.
Say that again?
Cultural conditioning.
That's correct. Now, we are only limited by what we perceive. And I guess if people stop and take the time, like myself, and again, I'm not licensed or accredited to be a how do you say, I guess, predict things. I don't like to use the word predict. I guess more or less feel things. We see things in 2D dimension because we're human. We're not supernatural, but we do have the ability to have feelings or emotions connected to everything that's around us. So when you're talking about remote calling or remote viewing, more or less, what you're doing is you're taking the ability to feel something, and this is in my opinion, to feel something in a certain pattern in the surrounding area, either atmosphere or just even the biological chemical of our Earth, or just even our physical being. I take it that when I look at something or if I feel something in my mind or I see something, now I've had past experience with feeling something and actually having it be a reality sometime later on. Now, that's not I'm not saying I'm a psychic. I'm just saying that prediction or being able to visually see something within your mind that maybe nobody else can see or feel is all about how you take or perceive the world around you. How do you... how does one take it onto himself to find a way to be able to communicate with non-living things or non...
Actually, it's a good, very good question. I've even attempted to discern how a tree, an evergreen pine, in one case, a particular species, perceives the universe and Gaia, and the Gaia, in terms of the Gaia theory too, in terms of planets.
A live planet.
Yeah, because this topic is so complex, please go into my forums where I teach, learnrv.com, and explore it there. Because there's no way for me to give you a curt, terse answer to something like that or address the questions. Go into my classroom and we'll discuss it at length.
Ed, what do you do next? What's on your plate these days?
Gold.
Hunting?
Finding. Yeah.
Any luck?
I do not wish to be an economic slave.
Are you looking for it for yourself or what?
I have a few clients that I'm finishing up work for and then myself, yes.
Are these clients like companies that...
No, they're individuals, and I probably will not do any more corporate work. Things are moving.
You're going through a metamorphosis, aren't you?
Maybe menopause, male menopause or something like that, hot flashes and all that. No, I am just I'm just mellowing out, I guess.
You?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Ed, let's keep in touch, my friend. We'll see what happens in the next couple of months.
Yeah, I'll try. Maybe I can catch you in Reno.
I think that's a Sunday, one of the days, right?
Saturday and Sunday. Especially for the evenings where I meet with my troopers and we kick back, let our hair down, and we discuss.
Okay, that's in a few months. Okay, keep in touch.
Roger.
All right, that's Major Ed Dames, of course, Dr. Doom. He does sound like he's mellowing out a little bit, doesn't he? He really does. But he still thinks the kill shot's right around the corner. So you got to be careful about that. Great programs in store for you for the rest of the week, by the way, so make sure you're part of it. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.